Welcome back, amigos, to episode 43 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the Baron of All Baseball Podcasts. Before we are joined by this week's special guest, I would like to ask a favor if I might. If you could, please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, as this helps us gather additional listeners and a larger audience to the show.
This is Matt from MattsBats.com, and you're listening to the Nats GM Show.
And now, I am proud to be joined by noted hitting guru at AB Athletic Development and owner of TukesHitting.com, Bobby Tewksbury. Bobby, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be on.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on this week. I'm a big fan of your work, both online, obviously with Twitter. And it was very exciting to see you just a few, well, I guess a couple weeks ago now, at the All-Star Game festivities. So I was eager and hoping that I could get you on the air. So I'm very excited to talk to you this evening.
Yeah, it's again, I love being able to share stuff, and very excited to be able to talk to you.
Well, let me first and foremost, let me give you the floor to just introduce yourself to the audience. How you got involved in baseball, how you became kind of a guru with the swing, and how you started working, you know, with Josh Donaldson.
Yeah, so I've been doing my facility up here in New Hampshire full time since 2009, and I hate the word guru. I know it's convenient to use, but pretty much all I try to do is understand what the best hitters do. I feel like throughout the history of the game, the right way to swing a bat has been shown to us. And when you study all the all-time greats, it becomes pretty obvious that they're all doing similar stuff in terms of how they're creating a barrel path. So what I do is I study a ton of video. I work with hitters. I started the Tukes Hitting site a couple years ago now, and I use that platform to share video, and I have a book about hitting mechanics and swing mechanics, and just try to put information out there to help hitters. And it's been picking up quite a bit of late since the Derby, but I just try to teach hitters the best way to swing a bat.
Now, do you work primarily with high school hitters? I mean, I know I've mentioned Josh Donaldson. I'm sure you work with some other, you know, bigger names. But what is your primary? Who do you primarily work with?
Well, my facility, we have teams from age 10 through 18. I work with college players. I work with pro guys. I've been trying to with my time. I've been trying to focus more on the upper age groups and pro guys. I have staff here that works with the younger kids. It's for those guys. We're trying to create foundations, but trying to just help them to learn how to be passionate about the game and have fun and get some good fundamentals. It's not about, you know, fine-tuning an 8-year-old. So we work with everybody. The information applies to all age groups and baseball and softball. So, it's the facility. We do stuff across the board in terms of age and sport. And then online too, it's with the book, it's, you know, a lot of dads who are buying it, a lot of college coaches and high school coaches who are implementing the information. So it's really, it goes out to everybody.
Well, and you said something earlier in your first answer that caught my attention when you said that it's pretty well regarded, you know, through history, you know, the way to swing the bat. What video or what players do you watch through history to, you know, when you say this is a guy that we should study and learn from?
It's fitting that we're talking on the Hall of Fame induction night. Or, you know, it, all the best hitters, all of the all-time greats. Ted Williams is a favorite of mine. You can look at Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio, Jimmy Fox. You know, just throughout the history of the game, that the hitters that are the ones that can hit with average, hit for power, the most productive hitters. They create a mechanical advantage with how they swing the bat, how they make the bat enter the zone, with the quickness they create, with how adjustable they are. So when you watch those hitters, you understand the effect that their body parts have on their barrel path and how they are able to, you know, create their swing. And current hitters that I like, I love Bonds was tremendous. He's probably got one of the most efficient swings of all time. Albert Pujols, Miguel Cabrera. I love watching Joey Votto hit. It's not all all-stars swing the bat really well because there's a lot of really good athletes that can get away with stuff and they're athletically quick enough to make swings work. But the ones that are really, really great, Hall of Fame caliber guys, so those are the ones you want to watch.
Is there any one thing or two things that they all similarly do? Is there one kind of common theme to all their swings?
Yeah, there's I look at the swing in terms of characteristics. When I was writing my book, I was struggling to communicate how the swing works and how to compare one swing to another. So I finally came to the communication-wise, came to the conclusion that each swing has characteristics, whether it's the depth, the direction, the plane of the swing, which some people call attack angle. So the swing has all these characteristics, and the way that these hitters move, I call them movement patterns. So there's essentially three patterns. There's hitters that push the bat towards the ball, where they're using their body's turn to leverage some push with their upper body. There's hitters that kind of pull the bat, where they're using rotation to pull the bat into the zone. And then the last one I call the elite pattern, and it's, I hate that I called it elite now because there's so many people that jump on that elite name and everything's elite now, but my intent was that these are really the top tier guys ever, the truly elite hitters. And in simplified terms, it's kind of a combination of linear rotational where they're using their upper body to create lag with a swing while their lower body's opening. There's the kinetic chain is really, really efficient. So they're essentially creating the quickest swing, the shortest swing, the deepest swing, the swing that's in on plane the longest. They're really, it's just maximum mechanical efficiency, and applies to baseball, softball. It's the big variable in hitting is hitting in baseball versus say like a golf swing is there's a timing constraint. So especially these days where you have almost every arm out of the pen is 95 plus, if not 97 plus, being quick is the biggest benefit you can create as a hitter. So it allows you to wait longer. It allows you to make better decisions. And when you're on plane, it's giving you the best chance to hit line drives consistently. So line drives are the most effective way to hit the ball. Try to hit the ball in good counts. And, you know, if you've got some athletic ability and hand-eye coordination, you might be able to hit the ball pretty well.
Well, let me use that as a jumping-off point to start talking about Josh Donaldson. Both give it a spot here to explain or talk about your relationship with him and how long you've worked with him, and also, you know, what's so elite about his swing as one of the great power hitters in the game right now.
Yeah, so I've been working with Josh for a few years now. I want to say 2012. One of his good friends, Adam Heather, came up to work with me. He flew up here from California in the middle of the winter. And when he got home, he started talking to Josh, telling him about me and what I talk about. So everything kind of launched off from there, where he started to implement some things and started learning about the swing and how it worked. From there, it's just been about understanding his movements. It's not intended to be like a secret or anything. It's just most people have trouble allowing themselves to understand it because it's different than what is conventional wisdom. So they'll battle it mentally, and you know they're a lot of their muscle memory will fight what we talk about. So for Josh, he's done a great job understanding the movements, the things that make his swing so good. When you boil down the movements, it's how are you getting ready to see the pitch, and then how is your body responding to the pitch during pitch recognition. So with Josh, he's got the bigger leg kick. He's got the lower hitch with the hands. Those are just style things that he's found to work for him, because every hitter, style-wise, needs to find what they can do repeatedly and be on time with. So for him, he's gathering early and getting ready for the release of the pitch. And then as the ball is being released, his hands are coming back up, his lower body's opening. He's really creating a lot of depth with his swing, creating a lot of ability to get the ball in the air, to drive the ball to all fields, and to be quick enough to do it against major league pitching.
Now, is he a very cerebral type hitter? And I don't know how to phrase this properly, but he's definitely evolved as a hitter. I mean, he's a little older on the path and has really broken out to be a big-time power star. How has his swing changed over the years?
Yeah, I have some video of him in college. Is a lot more calm, kind of just pick the foot up and move it forward, quieter hands. He's definitely a guy who likes to talk swing. He likes to understand what he's doing. The guys that I work with that don't want to understand it, that want to just kind of see the ball, hit the ball, those I don't really – the stuff that I talk about with them, they just kind of they don't want to know in depth what they're doing. So it doesn't really work out very well. Or they won't seek me out. I'll put it that way. They wouldn't come to me anyway. But Josh is definitely a guy. He puts a lot of time and energy into understanding what he's doing. And for me, that's just being professional. He's, this is his livelihood. This is what he does. He's a professional baseball player. And when you're trying to become the best in your field in anything, you got to know the ins and outs, the what's, the whys, everything about what you're doing. I feel like that's being a professional. So with him, he definitely understands what he's doing. The biggest benefit with guys that understand it is when things aren't going well, they're able to make adjustments faster. They're able to understand what's causing failure and also what's causing success. So in theory, you're cutting off your cold streaks quicker and you're staying hot longer. Just trying to be consistent, because hitting in the big leagues is tough. You're going to have your stretches where you're really hot, and you're going to have stretches where you're cold. But when you understand it, you can go to the field each day with a better process and have a routine and understand what you need to work on and why you're doing it. Be very deliberate about how you work on things.
Now, I'd like to think, and I do know that my audience is pretty sophisticated, but we're not, we're certainly not hitting gurus or experts like yourself. If we looked at Josh Donaldson's swing, what is the one thing where you could say, okay, he really does that really well? Is there one thing that the smart amateur could look at and say, oh, okay, I get it. That's what he does really well.
Yeah, there's a critical differentiation in the swing. And in general, it's as the front foot is landing. And with elite hitters, what you see when the front foot is landing, the hands are working up and back. There's going to be style variations, so this isn't like a vanilla thing you can say across the board. It's, but with him, as he's landing, his hips are opening and his hands are working back. So if you look at his front hip and his hand, and really the barrel, because the hands move the barrel. So we have to understand the barrel path. But if you watch him from the front view, as his front foot is landing, his hips are opening. And so you can look at if you're looking at it from a center field camera, His hips are opening to the left, and then his barrel is also working in that same direction. So you see the bat getting flatter and his hips opening. So they're turning in the same direction. And hands aren't pushing forward at that point. He's creating depth. He's staying in, he's getting inside the ball later. And that's something I look for with hitters. Most hitters who don't swing the bat well, when their front foot is landing, as they're starting to turn, their hands are actually pushing forward. So they're working out of their depth. They're getting less inside the ball, and they have to kind of steer their bat into the zone to be successful.
That's really interesting. I've got that kind of picture in my mind's eye right now. That's a very interesting point. You're exactly right. So let me once again use that as a transition point. I'm assuming most of the people that are listening to this podcast were watching the Home Run Derby 2 weeks ago, whatever it was. They may not have recognized you on the TV, but you were the one throwing to Josh in the Home Run Derby.
Yeah. Yep, it happened. It's still pretty surreal, but
it was really neat to see you on the TV and being part of the festivities. I'd love to start with, okay, what was the first round like? You were facing, and I say you, we, you know, Josh Donaldson, you were facing Anthony Rizzo. What was that like? It was a close victory for you guys.
Yeah, so we were, you know, Rizzo was first, and I certainly didn't envy him for that. He was a guinea pig, and they had the thing that, just to preface this, they had given us, they took like the normal batting practice. There were like all the press, and it was crazy on the field before, like during the actual batting practice. But they gave us a 1 minute trial. They put a minute on the clock and let all the Derby participants have their pitcher throw to them with a minute on the clock. So I hadn't even thrown a baseball yet. So I'd just been like standing around. I introduced myself to Frank Thomas. I'm talking to Chris Berman and John Kruk, and I'm like just trying not to do anything stupid on the field. And they're like, all right, go throw. So I just hop up on the mound, start throwing BP. There's a minute on the clock, and I'm rushing. I'm trying to go fast. I threw probably six or seven pitches. I think the time is up. And then I look up at the clock. There's still 30 seconds left.
Oh, my gosh.
So at that point, I was like, deep breath. We can slow down. This is more time than I realized. Because everybody, we didn't know what the format was going to be like in terms of energy, in terms of, you know, pace. All the press kept asking the players, like, what's your strategy? And they kept saying, just hit homers. I'm just going to try to hit homers. What do you want me to do?
Right.
If the all the players that weren't in it that were talking to Josh were like, this is great. It's just like taking BP. Like, the old format rewarded patience and outs were very penalizing, so you had to wait. And it was just like, I think the hitters got too good at it, where they were taking a lot of pitches and being patient. And with this format, it's like the clock's ticking, action's happening, right? The Derby's happening right now. So when the clock is moving, it's happening. And everybody was kind of on the edge of their seat. So we did that trial run. And then went in the clubhouse. That was at like, I think, 7:15. So it was still 45 minutes. So did the trial, realized how much time we had. That helped me like not be stressed out, because I was getting a little, you know, I was anxious. So it's a new format, new big, huge stage, gonna be on national TV in front of 40,000 people. So,
right. Sure.
It was, you know, no big deal. And then, so we did the trial, went back in the clubhouse, had like 40 minutes to just kind of hang out. So I stretched, I went through, I did some foam rolling. I was just in the cage, kind of just trying to keep myself busy. It's like the, you know, dead time, 30 minutes, you're by yourself with four Major League All-Stars in the clubhouse, just kind of waiting. Then there's some TV stuff that happened where they did the announcement and they all walked up on the stage. So by the time the Derby was actually starting, we had gone back into the stadium cage underneath the bleachers, underneath, like, right off the clubhouse. So they had a TV right next to the cage. So I was throwing to him, just getting kind of dialed in. He wanted a little bit firmer than what I had thrown to him. So just working on the pace of the BP. And then with about 2.5 minutes left, we left the cage, come through the dugout. I'm like getting the chills just talking about it because reliving it. But come through the tunnel, walk up the dugout steps. Rizzo's struggling. I think he only had like one homer at the time. So I was like feeling good. I'm like, all right, we got a chance. You know, you could see he was rushing. He was, you know, snap hooking balls foul. He's pressing. Turned it on late a little bit. I think if Rizzo could go again, he'd probably hit 15 homers, 16 homers, because he's got some big boy pop. So, but he was struggling. That helped me relax a little bit. And then, you know, I'm standing next to the TV producer guy, and he's like, all right, go. So when he was done, I walked out to the mound by myself, threw some warm-up pitches, and, you know, before I knew it, the umpire guy was telling me, go. The clock was on. And go.
Now,
it's time to go.
Now, how nervous were you walking out there? You're the only one walking out to the mound, and it's, like you say, 40,000 people in the stadium, another however many million watching on TV. I mean, were you a little knees knocking, or how were you doing?
I was the 1 minute trial thing really calmed me down, because I knew all you had to, like, just don't rush. You don't have to rush. Because my biggest fear is I'm going to not throw strikes and make Josh look like an idiot. So that was my biggest fear. The other fear I had was that I wouldn't be able to feel my arms because, you know, I remember my first pro at bat and it's like you don't even have a body. It's your heart rate's going and everything's like fast. So I was trying to take a lot of deep breaths, trying to do a lot of normal things. I was like bouncing the ball off the mound. I always smell baseball, so I smelled the ball. But it was weird because when I visualized everything, because I was trying to picture, I've never been on a mound like that before. So, and not that I would, you don't throw BP in front of 40,000 people. So,
right, sure.
I tried to picture myself, you know, with the lights. I've played on Fenway. I've played in a couple of major league stadiums. So, it's not that I've never been on a major league field, but I was trying to picture the people and the lights and just the environment. And when I visualized it, I felt like the people were way closer, way like on top of me. Because at Fenway, like the luxury boxes feel like they're on the field, like they're over the field. And when I got up on the mound, the lower bowl is so kind of flat and pushed back. So I felt like the people were so far away from me. And the other thing was I went from the clubhouse to the mound, clubhouse to the mound. I never even looked up, to be honest. Even when he hit homers, I was like, I would look up to see the ball and then I had to pick up the umpire. So there was never really any time to like look up or I looked at the National League side like twice. But it was kind of structured in a way that I just had to get up there, make sure my arm was loose and then clock was on. So Rizzo struggling early helped. It was great to win the first round. It would, cause he didn't advance in the first round last year, in Minnesota. So it was cool to win. People keep asking me like, what's the best part of throwing in the Derby? And it's literally like being on the field, throwing in the Derby when the clock is ticking, you're in the competition. I was involved and that's the best part. So it was a lot of fun.
So you got I think it was a one home run victory over Rizzo, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was a walk off. So the clock stops as soon as you hit the last one. It's because it's a bracket format. So
sure.
as soon as you pass the person, you don't need to keep going. I think we were tied with like a minute 45 left and he didn't hit it until like 20 seconds left. So I was getting a little nervous. He had hit a ball foul with like 50 seconds left, killed it. It was the one that Sean Casey caught up way down the left field line. He killed it foul. And he was doing like a Fisk move where he was like trying to like pimp a homer. And I, off the bat, I know it's foul. I'm screaming, I'm getting the box. It's foul. He was put on a show. But I mean, we still had a lot of time. We would have had the bonus time as well. So, it was getting a little anxious as, you know, getting under 30 seconds, you need to hit one. So, okay.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
It was cool. It was just the coolest part of being in the Derby was being in it, but the best like single moment was going in the clubhouse after winning first round and just being like adrenaline flowing, being hyped up, walking into Major League clubhouse, you know, coming through the tunnel and just, it was awesome. And then I looked to my right and Ken Griffey Jr. was standing right there. So it was like, wait a second, we just won the first round. Ken Griffey Jr. standing in front of me. This is crazy.
Okay. So now you had to talk to Griffey, right? I mean, you have to have talked to him, right?
So I saw on Twitter or something that he was throwing out the first pitch. And I mean, I'm 31. When I was 10 years old, Griffey was Griffey. He's the man. He's,
yeah,
you know, he's the Mike Trout, Bryce Harper of today, of my growing up. So for him to be there, I was trying to think of what to do without being an idiot. So I actually I shook his hand right after our round. I think he was coming off the ESPN set. So I spun my hat around backwards and shook his hand because it's like, it's Griffey. You know?
Yeah, right, exactly, sure.
So I spun it around real quick and just said, you know, it's a pleasure to meet you. I don't even know what I said after that, but, you know, your childhood icon type thing. Pretty special to meet somebody like that. So we didn't really talk anything. I took a couple selfies and they came out brutal, so one of the clubhouse guys snapped a real picture, so I have a nice picture with him.
Oh good.
Yeah.
So then what? So now you're still in the clubhouse, you've met your idol, and now you've got to go back out and face the hometown favorite.
Yeah, well, we won, and we went second overall, so we had to wait for six more people to go. And depending on the seeding, we didn't know if we were going first or second in the next round, because if Frazier obviously won, so he was, I think he was the two seed. Whoever he beat, I forget who he beat in the first round, but that was a seven seed. So we're just kind of hanging out, waiting. I think I popped my head out a few times. I was trying to, my fiance was out in left field, so I was trying to like spot her. And so we get back in the cage when Pujols was hitting, and he walked off whoever he was, I think he faced Bryant in the first round. So we're like just in the cage, just trying to get back into a rhythm. And I throw a pitch, he hits it, and then he goes, Pujols just walked off, and he just took off. So I'm like, I run out of the cage, we go through the tunnel. And then it's, you know, then it's time to go again. Round number two is way more stressful than round number one, knowing that you have to post a number. It's just more, you don't know what, you're not chasing. When you chase down a number, it's, I felt like all the hitters, when they had a number to beat, their natural competitiveness, they were, everything that makes them who they are as an all-star was able to just come out. You know, they're the best hitters on the planet, ultra competitive, and it's like, all right, I bet you can't beat me, and see what they do. You know,
It's easier to chase, that's for sure.
Yeah, so the first round chasing, we knew the number. He hit a bunch early, so it helped. And then the second round, you know, you could tell he was getting tired. I was actually shocked that they hit so many in the last round. I thought the guys were going to be gassed. But he had a couple balls that he squared up that didn't go out. I'm like, okay, he's tired. Then I feel more pressure to throw the perfect pitch and, you know, just trying to do a good job for him, because he's, you know, it was such an honor that he asked me to do it. So I'm trying to just make sure I give him the best chance that he can. Sure. to hit homers. And then once we were done, obviously Frazier, I thought we were going to go to a playoff, because he looked like he was tired. He rolled over like five or six in a row, mm-hmm. with a minute and a half left. And, you know, you have no control over the moment. He's the one in there. You're just kind of sitting there seeing what happens. And I thought we were going to go to a playoff just based on how tired he looked. And then the crowd went nuts. The energy that the fans created for him, like, they carried him for sure. Like, they just carried him. And he, you know, he ended up walking off on us and ended up winning the whole thing and put on a great show. I was standing next to Pedro Alvarez during the last round. Or not Pedro Alvarez, Pedro Gomez, the ESPN guy. Mm. And I was like, he's writing the story for you. You don't even have to say anything. Just let this happen. And it was cool. It was very, very surreal experience to like be on the field. You know, you watch it when you're a kid. You watch the Home Run Derby. You see all the guys on the sideline, and it was never like a bucket list thing for me to throw in the Home Run Derby. You just don't think about that. But it was a very special experience.
Well, and you know, 20 years from now, when we're talking about that All-Star game, we're going to be talking about Frazier winning the Home Run Derby, most likely, as the memorable event of that week or that weekend. Sure. So,
yeah, I actually attended the Home Run Derby in Yankee Stadium when Josh Hamilton hit billion homers. And, like, nobody remembers anything except for that, you know, that round when
he didn't even win, I remember correctly.
Justin Morneau won.
Yeah, that's right.
But he won that weekend. He was the story. He was the moment. And, you know, Frazier deserves it. He put on a show. He put on an absolute show. And the fans did a great job. And it was just with it being a new format and, you know, nobody really knowing how it was going to play out, they had actually changed the format that day. We didn't know the exact format until 6:15 that day, because there was a weather front coming in. They took away the final minute. They took away the extra bonus time. If you hit it like over 475, there was another tier of bonus time. And they were talking about potentially even shortening it to 3-minute rounds. to get it into that weather window. So, you know, new format with the clock running, it's just the home run, it's happening. I think everything that Major League Baseball was trying to accomplish with making it more entertaining, and I heard that the TV ratings were up like 26% from the previous year. You know, it brings excitement to the game, and if that's helping to get kids involved in the game, then, you know, it's tremendous.
Yeah, horrible pun alert, but they knocked it out of the park with the new format.
So. Horrible pun. I love it.
Thank you very, very much. I tried. So yeah. I've got a terribly worded question, but do you have any other just memorable or great stories from the event?
Yeah. Albert Pujols was like, his swing was what made me question everything I thought I knew about hitting. So
interesting. Okay.
There's a specific clip when I, summer of 2009 was when I had to forget everything I knew about hitting. So there's a clip, it's called Pool 7. It's when I watched that clip for the first time, what I thought was right in terms of like the hip and the hands coming together, what I had always been taught, what is very, very conventional wisdom in terms of hitting, what's supposed to be happening. When I saw his swing, he was doing the exact opposite of what I thought was right. So I'm sitting there looking at a clip saying to myself, this is the best hitter on the planet. He's doing the exact opposite of what I think is right. I'm the one who's wrong. Like, what I believe is right is not right. So in a lot of ways, Albert Pujols was the reason I was there, because everything that I've learned since is what I've tried to share with Josh. Josh being there, you know, his growth as a hitter, a lot of it is obviously it's him and his skill, and he's the one that's doing it. But information wise, Albert Pujols played a huge, huge role in that. So I had one of my T-shirts with my Tukes Hitting logo on it, and I had Prince Fielder, Manny Machado, and Josh Donaldson. Obviously, I had all three of them sign it, and I was trying to get all the American League participants to sign my shirt just for something to have. So I was kind of stalking Pujols in the locker room. There were a ton of reporters on him, and I never want to be that guy. And I don't know, when you're in the clubhouse, it's a privilege, and you don't want to be the guy that's like disrespecting the culture and the environment in there. So I was trying to be extremely respectful of that. But at the same time, I wanted to thank him. So I asked him to sign the shirt and told him what he means to my life at this point. So he had the Sharpie in his hand. He's getting ready to sign the shirt. And he's like, oh, that's so special. Like, thank you for sending that to me. And he took out a bat and signed a bat for me instead. So it was...
That's awesome.
Pretty cool. I was like, come on, man, you didn't sign my shirt. You gave me like a sweet Marucci with your autograph on it. Like, it was just pretty incredible. So I was like joking around, because it was like full baseball geek mode at that point, where I'm like not pouring my heart out to him, but I was, you know, telling him what he meant to my life, which is kind of, I guess, awkward. But the funny part about that is we go, Josh's agency had a post-derby gathering, a little party at a steakhouse in downtown Cincinnati. So I had to pack up all my stuff because I wasn't staying for the All-Star game. So I packed up all my bags, and we walked back from the stadium to the hotel. And our whole party of people, all of Josh's family, my fiance, one of Josh's friends, Adam, was actually there, the kid that introduced me to him. So they all went straight to the steakhouse, and I dropped off my stuff at the hotel. So I finally get to the hotel, walk into this private party, and the first person standing in front of me is Albert Pujols. I'm like, great. And he's like, hey, long time no see. Give me a hug. I was like, oh, man, I shouldn't have geeked out on you. That's embarrassing.
That's so awesome.
It was pretty funny. But he was awesome to me. Russell Martin was awesome to me. Got to talk to Sonny Gray a little bit, because he was before Pujols' second round, Sonny Gray was in the cage with his 5-month-old son. And I guess Pujols is one of Gray's favorite players, and he asked me to take a couple pictures of him. And so I talked to him, and he was, you know, they're all great guys. So many guys went out of their way to shake my hand and introduce themselves to me. And I'm like, I'm just here to throw to Josh. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, in the way Griffey is to probably you and I in our age is probably the way Pujols is to Sonny Gray in that age.
Mm-hmm.
It's just crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So, it was just all the guys were great. It was a tremendous experience. I can't wait for, like, I don't have any kids yet, but when I have kids and the Derby comes on some random summer in like 10, 15 years to be able to like pull out some pictures and talk about it. And it's just surreal.
Yeah. That's going to be a great moment when he's like, Dad, you don't know anything about hitting. Oh, really? Yeah. Well, watch this, you know?
Yeah. You know, happy, healthy, all that kind of stuff. That's my real concerns for when we have kids. But, I got some trump cards if they're going to tell me I don't know anything about hitting.
I was going to say, that is the ultimate trump card.
Yeah.
Well, here's a bat by Pujols. I think I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, long time for now, but well, some lifetime memories for sure.
Well, if I can somehow transition off of that, and I don't know how to do that well, but I'd love to transition and talk a couple of players and their swing, if I could, and just get your thoughts. This podcast is Nats GM Show. Obviously, it's heavily focused on the Nationals and the Orioles, the local teams in the area. Bryce Harper is kind of, I think it's fair to say, has become the player we've all expected him to become this year. What have you seen in his swing and the maturation of his swing maybe from, you know, when he broke into the league at 19 a couple of years ago to where he is today at 22?
You know, there's a lot to say about just the experience of playing in the big leagues, where he, you know, he did what, the 1 year of junior college, then he went straight to pro ball from there, sped his way through the minor leagues. So he's been in the big leagues for a couple of years now, and just learning how to expect what the pitchers are going to throw, how they're trying to get him out. There's a ton of value to that experience, and you know, he's got a tremendous amount of physical ability. Obviously, he's a little man child. Even when he was in high school, he's stud athlete and all the potential in the world. But now he's just kind of realizing that potential, and I can only imagine how happy the National fans are that he's doing that. In terms of his swing, I don't see any major differences in terms of mechanics, other than it looks like he's not trying to deuce too much. In the past, I feel like he's gotten really aggressive, sometimes with his stride, sometimes with how aggressive he's opening up. So when I look at his swings, a lot of the time when I watch a swing, I'll just loop the video and just watch it over and over and over and over and just try to pick up, not really focusing on anything in particular, just kind of looking at it almost like with blurry vision, where I'll like look at the catcher but watch his swing, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it's like you're watching it in the peripheral vision and trying to see the whole movement versus just like, okay, I'm going to look at his hip right now. I'm going to look at his hands. So when you loop it, it almost looks like his hips are opening slower, where it's more synced up to his hands, and it's not trying to just murder balls and hit them to the third deck. It's more, okay, I'm on time. I'm going to be precise. I'm not going to try to do too much. And he's such a good athlete that when, you know, he gets barrel on the ball, he's going to hit it hard. I don't know what his ball exit speed numbers are like, but he's got to have some of the best in the game, I would imagine. I think it's more just experience and not trying to do too much. Probably some getting comfortable with his role. You know, it might just be his hair. You never know. His hair is pretty majestic this year.
He does have a nice flow. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
It's very strong.
He's got that homer move where somebody pulls the helmet off and he flicks it back. That's probably the secret to everything.
Well, and that's Ian Desmond's kind of signature move with the Nationals is the helmet pull. So, which leads to perfectly the next guy I wanted to ask you about. As well as Harper's, or as good as Harper's been this year, Desmond's probably been that bad. Aside from the last maybe 10 days or so, his season's just been absolutely, you know, terrible. What are you seeing with Desmond this season?
So you asked me about him earlier before we got on, and just in the clips that I've been looking at, I don't watch too many Nationals games. I don't it's not especially convenient to watch their games, so I don't catch a lot of them. I know he's a tremendous, tremendous athlete. He's got size, he's got strength. Just watching his swings, he has some decent movements in his swing, but he doesn't sync them up well. So he gets his hands back before his lower body opens, and then from there he kind of gets stuck where his hands are back, his hips are closed, versus having those movements working together where the hips are opening and the hands are going back. When that happens, you kind of, I guess, get cleared with your lower body so the barrel path can work through the zone and kind of release. So he's getting his hips he's getting his hands back and his hips are closed, and then kind of has to push out of that. So he's kind of blocking himself. He's a guy that, as an athlete, I would have him experiment with movement and just try to be free and try to be loose, because he's too good of an athlete to be stuck and restricted. And he's kind of blocking himself. So I haven't seen what he's looked like recently. I think last year he had a huge stretch where he was very, very, very hot.
The second half of the season last year, absolutely. He was scalding.
Yeah,
hot.
I remember some of my pro guys being like, what's going on with Desmond right now? And it's just he's letting his body work. The way he's doing it right now, the way I'm seeing it, he's just kind of – he's getting his hands back when he's closed. When he tries to open up his lower body, he's stuck with the upper body. He's not really creating lag against his turn. So everything gets just kind of pushed out of it, and very hard to be consistently on time to drive the ball like that. He needs the pitcher to help him. I'll put it that way. He's not creating his own success with that type of swing.
Now, is that I don't know how to say this the right way. Is that an easy fix? I mean, is that something that you can snap out of, so to speak, or is that something that takes an off season to really iron out?
So it goes back to what we were talking about with Josh, where Josh really understands what he's doing and why he's doing it. And there's so many players you wouldn't expect it, guys in the major leagues that don't really understand how the swing works. So they know what they feel and they know what they're trying to do and they have a plan, but they don't really – they've never stepped back from what they're doing to say, okay, what – objectively, what's happening? How is my barrel path working? And is it for better or is it for worse? They know their cues. They know what works for them in terms of thoughts and feels, but they don't actually understand the objective side of what's happening. So, for a guy like Desmond, I have no idea what his approach is. I have no idea what his what his mindset is in that regard. So, you know, it might just be he might, because he's gone through stretches in the past, so it's in his body, it's in his brain. But I couldn't even begin to tell you how long it would take for him, if he'd be willing to make the changes, if he even wants to know, because a lot of guys don't. So it's you know, you're dealing with people, so it's not an absolute science.
Well, and you make a good point. Some people aren't as, I don't want to say cerebral because that has a negative connotation, but some guys are more bat to ball than others. So,
yeah, and that's, you know, if it were the guy, like, you know, you hear stories about Miguel Cabrera being just the natural hitter. Just all his movements that he does that are so tremendous, he doesn't even realize he's doing it. He doesn't know. That's one of the reasons why, you know, they say some of the best hitters aren't good hitting coaches, because they don't know what they were doing. They'll tell you what they were feeling or what they were thinking, but they don't really truly, the things that they do that are special, if nobody's ever pointed it out to them, if they don't know it's different, then they're just going to tell you what they did and what they thought, but they're not communicating the full scope of what was happening.
That sounds a lot like what Ted Williams complained about when he was managing the Senators way back when.
Yeah. Yep.
So, final guy I want to ask you about, if I could, I'd like to go up 95 a little bit and ask you about Manny Machado.
Yeah.
I know a few seasons ago he had a, you know, a tremendous amount of doubles, and I'm not sure that he's getting the national recognition for how good of a season he's putting together. You know, we always talk about Trout and Harper and, you know, Kershaw and everybody and the great players, but Machado is more than right there. Kind of, are you seeing anything different from him, or what do you see in Machado's swing?
I've liked Machado's swing since he came up. I think he's got some subtle moves, but they're very good. I hope he can stay healthy because he's a good player. He's a very good player. Defensively, offensively, he's a good player. One of the funny things about the Derby was everybody was – the thing about when, you know, the ESPN, all the people were talking about him as a participant, they were saying that he's not the big, like, big power guy, that his homers – aren't the furthest. He doesn't hit him like 480. He hits him 420, and they were concerned about it. And then when he went, when it was his turn to hit, he was launching balls up into that second deck. And I actually had a little moment in the clubhouse where I was talking to him, and I was like, "Man, you were hitting those far." And he's like, "Yeah, I was trying to just hit him He was trying to hit him as far as he could. He was just trying to hit moonshots." So, I like his swing. I think his swing is repeatable. Again, a guy like him, you don't know how much of it's just natural, what he does, and how much he knows. But what he does is pretty good. I know he barrels a lot of baseballs, a lot of line drives. He just needs to stay healthy.
And maybe you can translate this for me, but he makes it look really easy.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he does that makes it so easy in the swing, but it looks like he's not, like you said, it doesn't look like he's normally trying to hit bombs. And then you see his BPs and he kills baseballs.
Yeah. So he's got some length to him. He's, I would say, fairly lanky.
Yes, absolutely.
Maybe wiry might be the best word. So he's got some length. He's got levers. And next time you watch him hit, pay attention to kind of how he's lifting his hands. And he's got kind of a subtle hand lift as his move is happening. So pay attention to when his hands are going up relative to his turn, relative to when his body's turning forward. And that's kind of the move that makes him good. So when the hands are going up as his body turns, that's allowing the lower body to really be the power source. He's allowing that kind of... Sometimes you can describe it as like a spiral up the body. So his hips turn, the kinetic chain kind of goes from the lower body opens up, spirals up to the torso, through the shoulders, and into the bat. And if you just push the bat forward when your lower body's opening, you're not getting that full kind of spiral effect. So when Machado lifts his hands up, he's creating great lag, and he's letting his body be efficient so he doesn't have to try to be strong, if that makes sense. Most people... whether it's baseball swing or the golf swing, when they try to do something with speed, they feel like they're being powerful with their upper body. So they let the upper body dominate the sequence. And when hitters do that, and golfers do that, it really disrupts the whole pattern of movement. So in baseball, you see guys that'll look like they're muscling up, where it's not like this effortless power that you see with Machado, where it's just smooth and has flow to it, has good rhythm. Machado's got, he's got some good moves for sure.
Yeah. Well, his balance also seems exceptional as well.
Yeah. Well, the, when you do it well, it's, the movement all balances out. So it's, there's a forward move, but the hitter will, it's like you got to go forward, but stay behind your front side. It sounds weird. So it's not a right to left transfer. It's kind of the whole body shifts forward, but you stay balanced in the middle. And when the turning is happening well, it's you're using weight shift, but it's not transfer from the one side to the other. It's like a whole shift of the weight. You're taking your center of gravity and moving it forward, and when you capture that, it's a pretty powerful move.
That's a great visual, actually. That's kind of leading me into 100 more questions, but I've got to be respectful of your time, and it's a good place to cut it off kind of here. Hopefully maybe we'll have you back sometime in the future to maybe talk some more general hitting. But
yeah, I'd love that.
I'd love to give you a spot here for your plugs, where people can find you on Twitter, Facebook, your business, anything you want to plug, please.
Yeah, so obviously I have my book on my website, TewksHitting.com, T-E-W-K-S, hitting.com. One thing that I'm pretty excited about, I'm doing a slow release on this, but I'm launching a new, it's called Elite Hitting System, and it's application of the information in my book. So it's subscription-based information and training program customized for hitters. So it's I'm very excited about it. Hitters submit video on a monthly basis. I'm going to send them feedback. There's a whole bunch of worksheets and stuff that they have to fill out. They have to do game logs and spray charts and keep track of their bat speed and stuff like that. It's a program that I'm very excited about because it's all about accountability and helping hitters get better. And I'm the biggest question I get, so when people buy my book, is they say, okay, I get it, so how do I do it? And my belief is that when you really understand this stuff, you can be extremely creative in how you create it, because everybody's different and you never know what's going to work and click for a hitter. So with this program, I'm going to get to work with hitters all over the country and be able to provide them with individualized feedback, help them become accountable, because the ultimate goal with all this stuff, like with Donaldson, you become your own best coach. You have to self-diagnose and you have to understand your process. That's mental, physical, how you prepare for a game, all that stuff. So that's what that new elitehittingsystem.com is the website for that. And that's the one I'm really, really excited about.
That sounds really great. That anybody from around the country and frankly around the world could get your expertise and work with you.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. It's because it's, you know, with a book about hitting, it's great because people, you know, usually when people read my book, I get feedback like, wow, this is new. I've never heard of this stuff before. But it's kind of like a one touch thing. You sell them a book and then it's over. And I want to be able to help hitters long term. You know, you get your kids that I picture myself when I was growing up. So I was the kid that, you know, playing wiffle ball in the side yard, never had a ball out of my hand doing. I grew up in New Hampshire, so we had snow all year. I was doing ground balls down my hallway, you know, just young, passionate, wanted to know everything I could about the game and become the best player I could be. And if I sell a book one time, I'm not helping that kid long term in terms of, you know, providing feedback and guidance and motivation and all that stuff. So those things take time, and to be able to work with a kid over time and be able to provide feedback and really help them understand the things that are going to make them successful long term. That's I'm really, really excited about it.
That sounds great. I wish something like that was around, you know, 15 years ago when I was playing high school baseball and failing miserably trying to hit. So
yeah.
Might have helped my career go a little bit farther, but probably
yeah,
not.
Everything we do at AB, kind of our, it's not a tagline, but it's kind of the foundation of what we do. It's everything that we offer as a business is what we wish we had when we were growing up. That's the basis of everything that we do. So we try to provide kids with the best opportunities to learn and grow. And the greatest thing that we witness is when kids, when they learn how to work, and it's like this mental switch that gets flipped where we don't need to tell them what to do. They know they're supposed to be doing things the right way. And that's in terms of effort and being accountable and stuff like that. And when that switch gets flipped, that's the most rewarding thing as a coach. I love seeing that.
Yeah, that's a great place to end and a great sentiment. So, I want to thank you so much for clearing some time on a Sunday night. I learned a ton. I can only imagine the audience did as well. And I just want to thank you for sharing your stories about the All-Star Game. And it was really nice making your acquaintance.
It was my pleasure. I'd love to come on again sometime soon.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you. Standing invitation anytime you want.
Sounds good.
And that was my interview with Bobby Tewksbury at Tewks Hitting on Twitter, and as you heard, his other products as well. Definitely check him out. Wow, what a great just conversation, and I just learned so much. I'm still trying to digest all that information, frankly. So thank you for him for coming on. With that, episode 43 is a wrap. Bye for now.